get started, if people are here or not, I have lectured to empty classrooms. I'm going to just begin where I left off last time. I'm not sure I mentioned reflection, but that's where we're going to start. And I covered everything. If I didn't mention reflection last time, I mentioned everything up to reflection, and so we're just going to move right ahead and cover these again, optical phenomenon, optical properties, very quickly. Possibly by the next class, we'll be getting into actual components of spectrometers. So we'll be moving right into the building our analytical instruments, so to speak. This slide talks about reflection. It is a property that is also related to the refractive index that we talked about. And it comes about, as it says here, the definition of reflection: electromagnetic radiation strikes a boundary between two media differing in refractive index, and it bounces back. So here's an interesting question for you. Piece of glass. Why is it that you can see this piece of glass? It's transparent, right? You can see through it. Why is it that you can see it? Why isn't it invisible? Okay. Okay. But what about the glass composition makes it visible? Okay. Exactly. So part of the light is reflected. And why is the light reflected? Okay, well, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about because the substance, the glass, has a different refractive index than the air. And therefore, some of the light is reflected back to your eye. So you, although you see the glass, and that is a result of the fact that some light is reflected off of it back to your eye. Although we have, you know, transparent materials that we use for, you know, windows and things, we can see them because they don't have the same refractive index as the surrounding material. So that's what this is, you know, taking this theoretical concept of reflection and bringing it down to where we live. We live in a world where we see things, and we can see transparent materials because light is actually reflected off of them. So in this diagram, the incident ray of light comes in, and it bounces off of the surface. Now, if it were completely transparent, in the case of glass, some light does go through. And we know, of course, that because there's a difference in refractive index, to make this more accurate, I probably should draw the light beam like this, because it's bent a little bit, right? We talked about refraction. Okay, different phenomenon time. And so, but some of the light goes through, but some of the light is bounced off, okay? And that's the reflected ray, and that's what we're talking about. So if, again, there's a difference in refractive index, so here we have air, so we're dealing in air, and then we have a medium like glass. And this is, you know, we saw a diagram, I gave you a slide before that said glass, typical glass materials, have refractive indices in the 1.5, maybe as high as 1.7, but in that neighborhood, we might have a refractive index such as this. The situation that is described here is what's known as specular reflection. Specular reflection is where the angle of incidence is equal to the angle of reflectance, or angle of reflectance is equal to the angle of incidence. Why? Well, when would that not be? Okay, when would there be something other than specular reflection? Well, specular reflection is defined in terms of the surface, the interface, okay, between the two media and the normal to that surface. Okay, so we see that here. If I have a smooth surface, I'm going to have specular reflection. If I have a rough surface, okay, I may have light coming in, and then I may have light bouncing off at lots of different angles, okay, because the surface is rough. the normal to the surface is still the same, even though there are parts of the surface perfectly normal. The surface, we might have a rough surface. So this is a smooth surface. Right? This is a smooth surface. But we could have a very rough surface, and some light might be reflected at other angles other than theta 1 equal to theta 2. We also realize that if we took an electron microscope, the experiment we talked about surfaces of electrodes, if I took an electron microscope and I was able to look at this surface or any surface down at the angstrom level, okay, submicron level, I would find that the surface is not perfectly smooth. If the surface is not perfectly smooth, although glasses are smoother than most surfaces because liquids are the smoothest, glasses are a little bit are fairly smooth compared to most surfaces because they're actually not solids, they're glasses, okay? And but a surface tends to have a little bit of roughness to it. And so if I look at it, I find that there's some roughness. That would mean that when a light beam hits this, the majority of the light would be reflected specularly, but some fraction of that light might be reflected at other angles. So there might be a little bit of intensity of light reflected at other angles because of the roughness of the surface. All right. That's probably more than I wanted to say about reflection, but because there's it's a very important phenomenon. The parameter that we deal with when we talk about reflection is reflectance. Okay, so reflection is the phenomenon. Reflectance is the parameter that we would measure if you were so inclined to measure. So there's an equation for reflectance, as there's an equation for everything. And all we're saying, the intensity of light reflected divided by the intensity of light incident on a surface gives us the reflectance. So it's reflected divided by incident. And maybe 100% that most of the light is reflected. You have a nice mirrored surface. About mirrors later on. But you have a nice mirrored surface, you may approach 100% reflectance. The intensity of light reflected may be nearly equal to the amount of light that's incident on that surface. If we have a glass surface like this one, some of the light is going to penetrate through, some of it's going to be reflected off. If I hold it at the right angle, okay, I can reflect, if the sun were shining in here, if I had a nice intense beam of light, and the sun were shining in here, I could reflect the light off of the sun, the sunlight off of this, and shine it on the wall, right? And you'd see an image or a little spot on the wall. I was teaching an undergraduate freshman chemistry class one time, and I had a student sit in the back of the room, and he had his watch by the window, and he was shining the light off of the sun that was coming in. He was reflecting it on the blackboard while I was writing. I gave him a warning, before I threw him out of class. But and then I wanted to call his mother and say, "Who's paying this kid's tuition anyway?" But okay, so so he was having fun with his little, with his watch and shining the light off of it. So even though the watch crystal is glass, there's a significant amount of reflectance that comes off. So incident and reflected intensity. Okay, this is going from. The example that we've been talking about is going from air of a refractive index of 1 to glass, which has a refractive index of 1. And if we plug those numbers in up here, okay, we would get a value of 0.04 for R, or if we express it as a percentage of the incident light, 4%. Now, this is a special case in spectroscopy. The reason it's a special case and an important case is because in spectroscopy, as it says here, and each of those surfaces reflects 4% of the light, at least 4% of the light. Okay, so this is for normal incidence, all right, so if I have a surface, air and glass, and the light's coming in, okay, 4% of it is going to be reflected off somewhere. 96% is going to go through. All right? So you say, so big deal. I can afford 4%. 96% gets through. Not a problem. Well, let me present the problem. If I have a spectrometer and it has a light source, can I draw a light bulb? So I have a filament inside, okay. And light is coming off of this. All right? And then I have a lens. Okay, that the light is going to go through. And then I have a prism that the light's going to go through. And then I have the light beam that I want goes into a cuvette. And by the way, when it says 4% here, it's every surface. So the light comes out of from the source, it goes through a glass envelope. The glass envelope has two surfaces, one where it goes from the air into the glass, and one where it goes from the glass into the air. So there's two here. The prism is here, so there's two more. Then it goes into the cuvette. The cuvette has a surface here, a surface here, and a surface here. And whatever the stuff in the cuvette is, has its own refractive index. Maybe it's not air, because usually you don't use a cuvette with air in it. You use a cuvette with water in it, or solvent, hexane, methylene chloride, or whatever you happen to be doing. So there's four surfaces there, okay? Then I go from there, maybe into some kind of another lens, and then into a detector, which might be a photomultiplier tube, okay, which has so there's a couple of surfaces there, a couple there. Let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 14 surfaces I just mentioned to you, okay? Each one of them, we lose 4%. And it's 4% of what's left. So I got 100% light, I get 4% at the first surface, so I got 96% left. 4% of that, then I got some other amount left. And then I 4% and 4% and 4%. 14 times, and I built you the simplest spectrometer lenses in it. Right? If we had multiple lenses or other components in the system, we would lose light. So the bottom line is, we're going to lose a lot of light at this 4% minimum, right, if we're dealing with glass components. Now, there is a way around it. You can use mirrors instead of lenses. So if I use front surface mirrors. Now, the mirror that you got up in this morning and looked in the mirror. You looked in the mirror this morning, didn't you? Okay. Okay. Sorry. You got up in the morning, you look in the mirror. You're in the bathroom and you look in the mirror. Okay? And this, hopefully you recognize the person in the mirror. And that mirror is not a front surface mirror. That mirror is silvered on the back so that we can wash it. Right? And it doesn't affect the mirrored surface. But in spectrometers, they put the reflective surface on the front of the glass. You don't want to wash those. Okay, you don't want to be scrubbing those front surface mirrors. But in a spectrometer, there's a front surface mirror. So when the light hits that reflective surface, that silvered surface, then there's no medium that it's going into. There's no refractive index that we have to worry about, it just reflects off. So there's no 4% light loss. So if I were to use mirrors in place of these lenses, cross out the lenses and put mirrors in there, if I were to use a grating, we'll describe what gratings are, and I'll bring one in and you can play with it, instead of a prism, we wouldn't have a refractive index reflective loss there. So I just minimized 6 of my surfaces, or I just removed 6 of my surfaces in my spectrometer. So there's but I still got the cuvette, and I still got a source and detector that I'm stuck with. So, but I can minimize the effect a little bit. It says down here, 4% many lenses, light loss in a spectrometer. Where does the light go? It bounces around in spectrometer and causes what's referred to as stray light or stray radiation, and that's a problem that you have to worry about. So you got a couple of problems. One, you got to worry about loss of intensity in a spectrophotometer, and you got to worry about the stray light that might end up at your detector but didn't go the normal path. It bounced off of something and got to the detector without going through the normal light path. All right, so that's reflection. But I'm not done. Reflectance varies with the angle of incidence. This should be fairly intuitive to you, like the guy who was shining his watch crystal with the sunlight, okay? It only works at some angles, right? It doesn't work at all angles. You don't get all that light reflected off unless the light is at a steep enough angle that it doesn't mostly go through the glass, right? So you want it to hit at an angle where it will reflect off. So this diagram comes about, again, for the case that we've been dealing with, a refractive index of 1 for air and a refractive index of 1.5 for glass. Then if the light comes in at normal incidence, remember the diagram, right? Okay? Boy, that's a lousy diagram. Okay, so if the light comes in this way, okay, that's zero, that's an angle of zero, right, to the normal, because this is the normal that we measure all the angles off of. So this is 0 degrees. If the light comes through that way, there's going to be less reflected, and most of it's going to go through. 96% of it is going to go through. 4% is going to be reflected. So that's what this diagram is showing you, that about 4%, okay, is reflected, because this is reflectance on the y-axis and angle of incidence here on the x-axis. Now, as I take my light source and I move it down at an angle, at angles greater than zero from the normal, okay, so I move my light source from here and I start shining the light in at some angle, what happens? Well, nothing happens initially at the steep angles, but once I get out beyond maybe 30, 40 degrees out here, the curve begins to rise. As I get steeper and steeper, I begin to get more and more light reflected off. When I'm at this angle out here somewhere, I'm getting a lot of light reflected off. And this curve, you know, goes to the moon. It shoots way up. It goes up to 100% at the really steep angles. Right? If light's coming in at a really steep angle, near 90%, that grazing incidence that I talked about, then almost 100% of it's going to be reflected. The guy who was shining his light off of the watch, crystal sunlight as it comes in the window, well, he's getting a nice steep angle, okay? Hey, there's a bird in here. He's getting a nice steep angle as the sunlight comes in and reflects off of that piece of glass, and he's operating in this region, okay, because he's got a big angle. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, nothing to it, right? All right. Now that's all normal. Okay, this is for monochromatic radiation. Incident angle deviates from the normal. R tends to increase. Okay, so we see that. Now watch this. Oh, 4%. Okay. All right. Now, let's go the other way. Let's go from a medium of higher refractive index, like the piece of glass or water or anything, into a material of lower refractive index, like the air. Now, what happens is we run into a situation with our friend the critical angle. We talked about the critical angle last class. I hope I didn't confuse you too much, but we'll talk about it a little bit more, and then later we'll talk about it again, and sooner or later you'll figure out what it is. Okay, so it's the same diagram, percent reflectance versus angle of incidence, but now we're going from a medium of higher refractive index to a medium of lower refractive index. In other words, I'm coming through the glass, and I'm breaking out into the light, into the air, and the light is breaking out into the air. And it's all the same in this region. So in my little spectrometer thing that I drew you with all the different surfaces, if we're operating at normal incidence, okay, pretty close to zero from the normal, okay, it's still the same. It's still 4%. Okay, that's down here, right? That's this region right here. Okay. When I get to steeper angles, right, I have a little bit of a change. When I get above the 30% mark, okay, right here, the curve goes up, but it hits a wall and goes to 100% at some value which we have talked about before as the critical angle. Okay, the critical angle. And I have a diagram to describe that, 4% as before. Okay, critical angle. Here's my diagram. Now, I got a couple of diagrams here, so bear with me, and if you pay attention and you follow along, maybe you know all this stuff already. Anyway, we'll review it. All right, so we'll talk about the critical angle. Here it's written as phi sub c, and from the equation that I gave you before for reflectance, right, at 90 degree incidence, so this is 0 degrees, right? 0 degrees. 90 degrees is that grazing incidence situation that I told you about before. Okay? If we talk about, go back to your high school trigonometry or whatever, we find out that if we solve the equation that we talked about before for reflectance, what we end up with is a situation where the light is reflected, all of the light is reflected, and I guess, let me look at it this way. Going from lower refractive index to higher refractive index, we have our refraction occurring that we talked about before. So this is basically the same diagram I showed you before, grazing incidence, and light comes out at the critical angle, phi sub c. Okay. If I'm going in the other direction, okay, which is what I initially set up this example to be, when I'm going this way, at the critical angle, light will come out at 90 degrees. If I exceed the critical angle, there it is, okay, if I exceed the critical angle, if my incident beam of light comes in at an angle greater than the critical angle, it cannot escape the medium. The maximum, when I come in at the critical angle, I get 90 degree, I get light coming off at 90 degrees. Okay. If I was less than the critical angle, the light would come out and escape, okay, and I'd have refraction, okay, but I wouldn't have the reflection problem. So we have the refracted ray and the reflected ray. They sound similar, but they're different. Refracted ray is both of these are refracted that I drew. This one that was already here and the one that I drew. Okay, those are refracted. Light comes in, okay, at the critical angle or less than the critical angle. It's refracted, but it goes through the medium. If the incident light exceeds the critical angle, it's all reflected, or we get total internal reflectance. So this is the importance of the, this is one of the several reasons why the critical angle is very important. It causes this phenomenon of total internal reflectance. If I exceed the critical angle, going from a medium of higher refractive index to a medium of lower refractive index, the light cannot escape the medium of higher refractive index and stays inside of it and is totally internally reflected down through that medium. It's the ability to use that material as fiber optics, a fiber optic material. Fiber optics material is not really special material. It's just material that has a refractive index that's higher than the surrounding material. So I take any substance that light will pass through, and I figure out what its refractive index is, and then I wrap it, or I clad it, or I house it in some other material that has a refractive index less than that material. if that occurs and I shine light down through that material of high refractive index, the light will not escape. It'll just bounce around inside of it and be propagated through the material. Okay, so we have this situation of total internal reflectance, and it works for fiber optics. So what do we use fiber optics for? Well, I mentioned okay, but now, of course, today, many spectrophotometers use fiber optic materials, right? We have downstairs these inexpensive Ocean Optics spectrophotometers. They cost about $2,000, okay? And you can, the one that we have has a little board, and it plugs into the back of your PC, and out of the board comes a fiber optic cable, okay? And you shine light into that fiber optic cable, and the spectrometer that's on the board will measure, will take that light, disperse it into the component wavelengths, and tell you how much intensity of light is at each wavelength. And if you couple that with a light source and a cuvette, you got yourself a UV visible spectrophotometer. So it does that with this fiber optic instrument, fiber optic device. You can use fiber optics for measuring light as a probe, like you stick a pH probe in a beaker to measure the pH. You can stick a fiber optic probe into a beaker and measure absorbance, fluorescence, light properties such as those, scattering, of light and so forth. So we have the ability to use fiber optics in that way, as well as with telecommunications. And then I mentioned, I think, last time that in a refractometer, you're measuring the critical angle when you actually put material into a refractometer and try to measure the refractive index. You're measuring where the critical angle is in order to determine what the refractive index of that substance is. There's one other important application, and that is ATR cells. ATR is attenuated total reflectance. Okay. Attenuated total reflectance. What's that about? Okay, on an infrared instrument, you have an ATR crystal. Typically, that crystal is a thin crystal that is selected such that it has those refractive index properties that allow it to have a very high refractive index compared to the surrounding materials. Okay, so when you take your sample, okay, light. This is the ATR crystal. The light beam. That's supposed to be light. Comes down and hits the crystal, and what happens is the light beam bounces down the crystal like this. Okay, you put your sample. Maybe you put your sample in our instrument. You can take a drop of liquid and just put a drop on the crystal. Okay, so you put a drop of something on here. What happens is, as this light beam goes down, it penetrates a little bit into the sample. I won't get into evanescent waves, but the light just barely penetrates the sample. And as it does that, it may be absorbed by the sample. If we're doing infrared absorption measurements, then the light that's bouncing down the length of the crystal may be absorbed a little bit by that drop of material sitting on the surface of the crystal. Since the light's bouncing, it may bounce into that sample many times. Now, I drew it as not too many bounces, but it might actually penetrate the sample 100 times. Even a little drop of sample. And by doing that, the light is absorbed and therefore attenuated. So you compare the intensity of light without the drop there, okay, with no drop, versus the intensity of light with the drop, and what do you end up with? You end up with the amount of light absorbed. And so by a very simple but clever device, an ATR crystal, you just put a drop, or you can put a piece of plastic on there, a film, a solid. You can put solids on there, anything on there, and measure its absorbance without actually having to have a special cell or a special device, a holder to put it on there. You just have this ATR crystal. All right, so this is attenuated total reflectance, and it works based on this total internal reflectance phenomenon caused by the critical angle, which comes from the refractive index properties of the materials. All right? Great. Okay. Let's forget all of that and talk about polarization. Polarization, not to be confused with polarizability. We talked about polarizability. Has absolutely nothing to do with it. Polarizability was the ability of the electron cloud, right, to be influenced by electromagnetic radiation or whatever, and that comes about from the idea of you have poles, right? So the electron cloud in a molecule is negatively charged, and if light comes through the electric vector of the light influences that electron cloud, it may shift the cloud, or the cloud may respond, and so we create a pole or a dipole situation where we have a negative region caused by electrons and a region that has less electrons, so it's sort of positive. That's all polarizability. This is polarization. This is polarizing light. Okay, this is causing light to oscillate in a particular plane. All right. And so it says here electromagnetic radiation is unpolarized, meaning that the electric vector of the light is in all directions. So if we were thinking of the light as a wave, right, that's what we talked about before, as a sine wave, the light's coming through, right? Well, it's actually many, many sine waves, right? Some of them are oscillating in this plane. So, you know, this is the electromagnetic radiation in this plane. And then I could draw another beam in this plane, which would be here, and then this plane, and then this plane, and then this plane, and then this plane, and pretty soon it's just a big mess. Okay? Yeah, I failed art in kindergarten. But the idea is that the unpolarized light is oscillating in every possible plane, 360 degrees around. The light's propagating in a certain direction. It's oscillating in all possible planes if it's unpolarized. Right? We polarize it. Okay, I would have brought in, you know, those cool sunglasses, polarizing sunglasses. Okay, this is the major application for this phenomenon is sunglasses. Okay, what do? We use a polarizing filter. Okay, a piece of glass that is causes the light to be polarized. It absorbs when the sunglasses either are they either have, you know, the kind that have the mirrors on them. Okay, those type of glasses reflect the light that is not in a certain plane and only allows light of one plane to pass through. I said the light's traveling towards your eyes. You got the picture yourself with those sunglasses on. You know, you're being really cool. You got the sunglasses with the mirrors on them, okay? And they're polarizing filters. And the light is coming through, and the light is oscillating in all planes, but those glasses reflect most of the light, but they allow light reflecting only in one plane to pass through. Okay? You see the same thing you see without the sunglasses on because all of the light carries the same information. It's either coming from a light source or it's reflected off of a substance, off of a material, and it's going towards your eyes, and it's oscillating in all planes. You get rid of all of it except the light that's oscillating in one plane, and that passes through the polarizing filters, those lenses and those polarizing sunglasses, and reaches your eyes. Now, and so you see the same image, but it's at a less it's less intense, okay? And that's what you want sunglasses for. You want to cool the intensity. You want to be kind of mellow, you know. You want to be chilling. That's the vernacular, the current vernacular. Okay, you want? I'm chilling with my sunglasses on. I should have brought my sunglasses. Okay. You can also have non-mirrored sunglasses that absorb radiation in other planes and only allow one plane to be transmitted through. So they don't have to be mirrored. Okay, so if you're not into the mirrored look, I think that's out now. Mirrored sunglasses are out. Okay, but you can have the kind that absorb light. So the same. It's the same principle. It's a different type of lens. Now it's absorbing radiation that's oscillating in other planes, but it's allowing one light oscillating in one plane to pass through. Again, you see the same thing because the light carries all that information. You got rid of light that is too bright for your eyes or maybe is glaring off of, reflecting off of other things and causes a problem for you to see. Okay, so light, it says here, polarized light oscillates in one plane. Okay, look at this. It's a movie. When you printed these out, it's not moving on your paper. This is linearly polarized light, okay? So the electric vector is red, so it's oscillating. This is supposed to show you that it's oscillating as it travels along. The blue vector is just the magnetic vector, which we never deal with. Okay, so the light is oscillating as it travels along. Okay, great, big deal. How about this one? What's this light doing? It's dancing. Okay, you got your cool shades on. Now you're dancing. No, that has nothing to do with it. Okay, this is circularly polarized light. If I were to draw this. Okay, I would have to draw it like light that's kind of rotating as it goes. It's like a corkscrew. Okay, so it's oscillating, but as it oscillates, it's rotating. Okay, so it's rotating that plane. So my hand represents the sine wave that's oscillating up and down, and as it travels through space, it's rotating. Now it can rotate it to the right, or it can rotate to the left. You can have right-handed circularly polarized light or left-handed circularly polarized light. If you combine right-handed and left-handed, that's all on the slides, right? Right-handed, left-handed, it moves through space. I think it should say that here. Combining equal beams, one right-handed circularly polarized, the other left, gives you linearly circularly polarized. Not circularly polarized, linearly polarized light. So you got one going this way and one going that way, and you combine them and you get one going this way. Why do we care? Because there are techniques, and these are the three that I could think of, optical rotatory dispersion. You know, we want to measure optical rotation. What causes optical rotation? Chiral centers. I've made you nauseous before with physical chemistry. Now I'll make you sick with organic chemistry. Okay, we're talking about stereoisomers, chiral centers, light interacts and is rotated. So we have optical rotation. Right. So that's the kind of thing that we do with polarized light. We can measure optical rotatory dispersion, ORD. We can measure circular dichroism or fluorescence polarization. All right. We could talk about any one of these techniques. I'm not going to spend any time on any of these three other than to say that you're talking about rotation of light. You're taking polarized light and you're looking at how much it's rotated by a molecule. In the case of the fluorescence experiment, what happens is you take polarized light, okay, it's oscillating in one plane, it's absorbed by a molecule, the molecule goes to an excited state, okay, that excited state then emits fluorescence. That fluorescent light is polarized also, but it's polarized, but its plane of polarization may shift depending on movement of the molecule. So if the molecule is able to move in the time frame of the fluorescence lifetime, then you will notice that the light that I was originally in this plane is rotated by some number of degrees. So we measure the number of degrees difference between the incident light polarization and the emitted light polarization. That tells us that the molecule moved in the amount of time that it took for the excited state to go up and come back down. Why was that important? Well, that tells you something about the size of the molecule. Because a big molecule rotates slow in solution. A small molecule rotates faster. And therefore, it tells you something about the size of the molecule and the kinematic viscosity of the medium. Right? If it's in a viscous medium, it will rotate slowly. If it's in a non-viscous medium, it'll rotate more rapidly. So it has to do with the size of the molecule and the viscosity of the medium, how quickly things rotate. And if we, in case of fluorescence, we know something about the time scale of the fluorescence measurement. It's on the order of nanoseconds, typically. If we know the lifetime of the, we can measure the lifetime of the molecule, nanosecond, picosecond lifetimes, then we can do calculations that will tell us something about the size of the molecule. So people who work with macromolecules, whether they are proteins, whether they are some other material, or whether they are synthetic, can do a fluorescence polarization experiment to determine the size of the molecule. Right? So there's information here. Yeah? That information, that you're talking about, molecule chiral molecules. Okay, so you understand the concept of chirality. We have a carbon atom in a molecule that has four different groups attached to it, all different groups. Okay, that's a chiral molecule. Okay, that's a chiral center. Molecules can have several chiral centers, okay? But often we have molecules with one chiral center or that chiral center in the molecule causes that substance to rotate light, okay? If it has a chiral center, if there's one chiral center, there are two stereoisomers. Okay, in other words, there's a right-handed and a left-handed version of that molecule. They're mirror images of each other, right? If they look in the mirror, okay, they see themselves, right? But in reality, they're not the same because they're mirror images. Chemically, they're the same substance, right? And this is a big deal because in the human body, it is R isomers, okay, are active. L isomers are not. So there was a company called Sepracor, a pharmaceutical company, the total premise of the existence of that company is the fact that people were making synthetic compounds as drugs, and they'd be mixture if the molecule had a chiral center in it, and the organic chemist synthesized it, they'd probably synthesize a racemic mixture which had both R and L forms in it. Only the R form was active. So somebody came along with a great idea. We'll make a company that only makes the R form, and we'll be able to take drugs that are already on the market, and we'll get a patent on making the R form of the drug, which is more active, is the only active form, and the L form is not active. And so when you look at so I assume what you're reading off the bottle of the substance is what the percentage of R and S forms are. How do you determine that? You determine the amount of R and S typically by doing by measuring the rotation of light. Okay, so if you have a pure optical isomer, you can determine that it rotates the light. Again, R and S are going to rotate the light in different directions. We could spend a lot of time on this, but I didn't really want to. But that's the idea. That's the concept. Okay. Let's move on. This is the important stuff. Okay. After talking about all of that, we want to deal with absorption and emission. Okay. These are really interesting and useful when it comes to electromagnetic radiation interacting with matter. That's our spectroscopy that we defined last class, I guess, at the beginning. So what we want to say here is atoms and molecules can exist in different states. How can they exist in different states? Well, we're going to do electronic spectroscopy primarily. Right? We'll talk a little bit about vibrational spectroscopy, but primarily we're going to do electronic spectroscopy. We're going to deal with visible and ultraviolet light. The energy of visible and ultraviolet light is sufficient to promote electrons, outer shell electrons, I should say, in a molecule to upper states. And so if we measure the absorption of the outer shell electron being promoted, the energy for that absorption, it's going to be in the UV or visible region of the spectrum. We're going to look at the absorption process. If we look at the electron going from the excited state back down to the ground state, we'd be looking at the emission of light from that outer shell electron. We can do inner shell electrons, but then we've got to use more energy. We've got to use X-rays. We can do we'll talk in a couple minutes. I'll talk to you before class is over. We'll talk about all different kinds of spectroscopy and all the different things that are going on. But our main focus is going to be outer shell electrons, UV invisible regions of the spectrum. If we get into the infrared, we'll talk about vibrational a little bit. So a molecule which has many atoms, and certainly has more than one atom, and if it's a molecule, and it has many electrons, then there are many, those electrons are in different energy states, and they can be promoted to upper energy states. Because we're very simplistic in our little brains, we deal with the simplest case first, and so we've got two energy states, a ground state and an excited state, and that's what my little diagram right here is all about. Okay, so I got state one is the ground state. State two is the excited state. And if I absorb radiation, light energy comes in, okay, this is an energy scale, then the electron, okay, because we're doing UV visible absorption kind of spectroscopy, and UV visible light is the radiation that coincides with the energy levels of outer shell electrons in molecules, then that electron gets promoted to an excited state, state 2. It may then go back down to the ground state and cause emission. So we've got absorption and emission defined. We can talk about the energy for that absorption and emission process. The delta E, all right, the delta E, in other words, if this is an energy scale, then there's some delta, okay, delta E, for that energy difference. It's the energy of state 2, the higher state, minus the energy for state 1, the lower state, and that must coincide with the light energy that we're using to get it to get the electron to go up to the upper state, or the light energy that is emitted when the electron goes from the upper state to the lower state. Very basic, right? So E1 and E2 are energies. H is Planck's constant, okay? And nu is the frequency, okay? Frequency of the light. We could do it in terms of wavelength, but frequency is better, all right? Frequency is better. So E is equal to H nu, and the energy is equal to Planck's constant times the frequency. Frequency is directly proportional to energy. Wavelength is inversely proportional based on the equation I gave you before. So we can just multiply the frequency in appropriate units times Planck's constant in appropriate units, and we can get energy. All right? Okay. We're going to consider the light as in its particle nature, where before we've been do a lot with waves, all right? So we're going to talk about it as a photon or a bundle of photons with energy H nu. So that E, which is equal to H nu, is created by a bundle of photons or a packet of energy that strikes a substance, matter, and causes the electrons to be promoted to the upper energy states. Or it causes something to happen in the molecule. We're primarily interested in outer shell electrons, but it could be vibrational states or so forth. The rate of absorption or emission depends on three things. Okay, Einstein, another one of Einstein's discoveries. Of course, back then, a lot of stuff hadn't been discovered. It was just a wide open field. You know, he had it easy. Okay. Anyway, Einstein figured out that the rate of absorption or emission depends on three things. It depends on how many atoms or molecules are in that initial state, right? That ground state where the light is going to hit, and those atoms or molecules, the electrons, are going to be absorb that energy and be promoted. So it depends on how many of them there are there. Oh, I could have figured that out. Then it depends on the probability that transition will occur. In other words, I just showed you two states, ground and excited state. Well, the electrons going from the ground state to the excited state, they may not want to go to the excited state. Okay, they may not like the excited state. They say, I'm fine here in the ground state. Everything's cozy, comfortable. I like it here. I don't want to go to the excited state. There is a certain probability associated with the transition. That probability is the stuff of quantum mechanics. Okay, but I have this incredible knack of explaining things that you can understand it. How about this? If I have an electron traveling in an S orbital, S orbitals are kind of spherical, right? Right. So it's an electron traveling around. But what's a P orbital? P orbital is like a figure eight, a dumbbell-shaped kind of a thing. Well, if I got an electron that's traveling this way, and I want to promote it to an upper energy level that's going like this, it may not want to do that. It may have to put on the... It has to change course. Its normal course is circular, but when it goes to from the ground state S orbital, maybe to a P orbital, it would have to change its direction, okay, in order to make this figure eight shape. That's not a high probability. Electrons don't have brakes, okay? They just go. They have one speed, go. There's no stop, okay? There's no left-hand, right-hand, slow-down, you know, caution, none of that stuff. They just go, right? So to go from a spherical energy, a spherical orbital, to a pie-shaped nodal-type system is not a high probability, okay? Now, if I'm going from a P orbital to a P orbital, okay, they're the same shape, you know, that might be a high probability. So we can rationalize the probabilities of transitions based on shapes of the quantum mechanics people turn this into orbital overlap and you know, eigenvectors and eigenfunctions. Okay, we don't want to talk about that kind of stuff, right? But the idea is the rate of absorption. Okay, so how much absorption I get when I shine light on a piece of matter is going to be related to the number of atoms or molecules in the ground state, the probability that they'll go to the excited state, and then the third term is the radiation density. How much light? I could have figured that out. All right. So all Einstein was saying is, it's how much stuff you got, how much light you got, and whether or not the electrons or the atoms or molecules or whatever, however you want to refer to them, how likely they are to go to that excited state. That's all he was saying, those three things. Now, he went a little bit further than that. This all probably came to him in a dream because he did things as thought experiments, right? He kind of had bad hair, but maybe that had something to do with it. Anyway, the absorption experiment, thought experiment. Einstein was not an experimental guy. He was a theoretical guy. So he came up with this equation, which says... the rate of absorption, which is what he was interested in the first place. Now, don't get too excited here. It's just the change in the number of species in a particular state, right? So we have some number of atoms or molecules in a ground state, and they're going to go to an excited state. They're going to change. The number is going to change. So it's the change in N, the population, versus time. So it's dN dt. It's the change in the number of molecules or atoms in a given state with time. So that's going to be the rate at which they are promoted to the excited state. That is equal to number of atoms or molecules, which we said in the previous slide. A probability coefficient, So he didn't really talk about the probability. He just said, we'll give it a term. We'll give it a variable. We'll call it B. Okay? And since we're going from state 1 to state 2, we'll call it B12. See, Einstein was a pretty simple guy, actually. You know, really basic stuff. And then we have the spectral volume density, which is just a confusing way of saying the radiation density, how much light you have impinging, the intensity of light that's impinging on. So absorption, the three factors, are just included in this equation. And if you go to the, if you go to Washington, D.C., the National Academy of Science has a bronze statue of Einstein's outside of it. And there he is sitting with his notebook, and he has this equation written into it, etched in bronze. Anyway. Okay. When the light gets to an excited state, then it could emit. So that's another process. There's an emission process. It goes back down. It can go down spontaneously. In other words, it just goes down by itself, doesn't need anybody to help it. And so we have another equation. This is different because there's no radiation density term here. The reason there's no radiation density term here is because you don't need radiation. Don't need it. It's already, the energy is already there. The molecules go to the molecules, atoms, electrons, however you want to think of it, go to the excited state, and they just spontaneously emit the energy that they've absorbed as radiation. There's no external radiation required. We've got, again, dN/dt, rate of absorption. We've got N, the population now in the excited state, and Einstein's coefficient from state 2 to state 1, so we call that A. A is 2 to 1, B is 1 to 2, and somewhere I have down here, we'll come to that. All right. The third case, there is a third case. So we had absorption, we had spontaneous, now we have stimulated emission. Stimulated emission, a photon strikes the excited state and causes it to emit by the stimulation of the striking of that photon. There's another equation for that. That's this equation. And, whoops, I didn't mean to do that. Rate of change from the excited state to the ground state, number of atoms, molecules, electrons, whatever, in the excited state, state 2. We're going from 2 to 1 now, okay, not from 1 to 2. We're going from 2 to 1. Previously, we had 2 to 1 as A. Now, we got it as B. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then there is also a radiation density term because there is radiation that strikes the excited state to stimulate this emission. This down here tells you the relationship between the probability coefficients. B12 is equal to B21. So here's B21, excited state to ground state. Back here was B12, ground state to excited state. Turns out they're equal to one another. All right. So the coefficient, the probability coefficient for absorption and stimulated emission are the same. The one for spontaneous emission, the A21 term, probability coefficient, is related to the B12 term in a very complex way. Okay, we're not going to go into that, but I just want you to know that. All right, what's the big deal about stimulated emission? Lasers, right? Lasers work on the process of stimulated emission. As a matter of fact, laser stands for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. It's not really a word, it's an acronym. It's an acronym that's become a word. All right. So laser stands for light amplification by stimulated emission. So it uses the stimulated emission process to amplify light. All right. We'll talk a little bit about lasers, general concept, but the idea is I need a substance. Lasers are usually named after the substance that undergoes the stimulated emission process or the lasing process. Not the lazy process, the lasing process, okay? So it could be, the first laser was a ruby laser, not ruby slippers, but ruby laser. Okay, and the ruby laser, they use the ruby crystal, and it turns out that ruby undergoes this lasing phenomenon, or this stimulated emission phenomenon, where you shine light on it and you can create an excited state. You pump it, basically, is what it's referred to. So you pump the photons up into the excited state, okay, and they're all up in the excited state, ready to go, and then you trigger the emission, sometimes by a photon, sometimes electrically, and all of a sudden you get a burst of energy, right, of all of that excited state energies being stimulated in concert. Dun, 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 dun. We get them to all emit simultaneously, and we get a laser beam. Okay, we get a laser beam. We get so we get the lasing process. So it's important for lasers, but it's a stimulated emission process. Yes. Sigma. This is wave number. Let me write that in. Wave number. Okay. Which is usually in centimeters. Okay, so it's just the inverse of wavelength. Right? Okay. So we've got all that dealt with. All right. Let's mention Boltzmann's distribution, and we're not too excited as all this stuff is very critical chemistry point of view. I just need to understand. I think I probably said to you before. You know, you walk into this room and you become an analytical chemist, right? So we start to think, why do I need to know all this stuff? In order to make good analytical measurements, I need to understand the principle behind the measurement. I need to understand how it works, so therefore I can make better measurements. If I don't know how it works, I'll probably screw it up. Okay, if I don't know what I'm doing, I won't understand what the important parameters are, what the principle of operation is, and I'll do something foolish, and I will get bogus results. All that Einstein, are you ever going to use it when you're making an analytical measurement? No. Okay? But you need to understand how it works so that I can make better analytical measurements. The same is true with Boltzmann's distribution. Boltzmann's distribution, again, it's sort of a physical chemistry thing. Let's talk about it. It tells us something about the population of those two states. The N was important. Einstein figured out that he could define, I guess is the best way to say it, he could define what was going on with his absorption-emission process if we know something about the population of the states. Well, Boltzmann is the one who figured out what the population of the states are. Okay, and he did it with this distribution, and it really boils down to temperature. Okay, so it's really temperature and N are the two important parameters. Now, the bottom line is, if I've got two states, the simple system that I described to you, state one and state two, then they're related to one another, and they're related basically by the temperature of the system. Now, there's a Boltzmann's. There is energy of those two states. If the two states are close together, there's not much difference in energy between them. If far apart, there's a lot of energy, okay? So it makes a difference where the states lie on an absolute energy scale. So energy is important in all of this. But the bottom line is the two states are related by temperature, okay? Now, it matters what kind of spectroscopy we're talking about. And the next slide probably has this table that I drew up myself from somebody else's data. I stole somebody else's data and put it in here and didn't reference them. But the idea is this. You could calculate these numbers based on the Boltzmann's distribution. Okay. So all this says is energy separation and relative population of states. So the difference in the energies and the N's. Right? So here we got the type of transition. What are the different types of transitions? Well, there are electronic transitions. I explained to you that it's an electron going from, say, the outer orbital of an electron going to a higher energy level. You shine light on a molecule, its outer electron goes to an upper energy level. So that's an electronic transition. Then I have here, that's electronic. Then I have vibrational. Well, okay, so an outer a molecule has vibrational states, right? Bending, wagging, vibrating, right? All of that kind of stuff, all right? Well, those are not as high energy as the electronic transitions, but they have energy. Then there's rotational states, right? Molecules rotating around the bonds. Then there are electron spin states. Okay, electrons have a spin. And then there are nuclear spin states. All right, so, and we know electronic states are transitions that occur in the UV visible absorption. We talked about that. Vibrational are the states are what we measure when we measure infrared spectroscopy. Rotational, nobody measures those, but microwave spectroscopy. We only use microwaves to pop popcorn, but some people do microwave spectroscopy. Electron spin states, we can do ESR or EPR, electron spin resonance or electron paramagnetic resonance spectroscopy, not very popular. Slightly more popular than the rotational microwave type spectroscopy. And then we have nuclear spin states, which we do NMR all the time, right? We measure the spin changes in the nucleus. They're listed this way in the size of energy. So we've got wave number in reciprocal centimeters, which is directly proportional to energy, inversely proportional to wavelength. Then we have energy scales in two units, electron volts and kilojoules per mole, kind of old units, but that's what the data was that I had that I was borrowing. And so the idea here is that the electronic states, okay, use energies that are on these orders, okay? Now, actually, when we talk about the energy of the light, we're usually referring to reciprocal centimeters or electron volts. But we often refer to bonds and molecules that are made up of electrons in kilojoules per mole. Right? We often talk about the bond, a covalent bond having some energy in the kilojoule per mole range. The point is that if I have an electronic type of transition at this energy level, okay, and I think I calculated this, I'm forgetting now, I'm thinking it's around 500, I'll say for the sake of argument, it's about 500 nanometers. This is equivalent to 500 nanometer radiation. Then, for this particular situation, then but my energy in my system, okay, based on this temperature and the Boltzmann distribution, says that the ratio of states, how much, what's the population of the excited state? Very, very small. Compared to the ground state. The ratio of N to N, N2, excited state, N1, ground state, is 10 to the minus 41. At normal room temperature, okay, the excited state corresponding to that transition, right, has like no population. Nothing's there. Everything's in the ground state. Why? Because the energy gap is so big that you would have to supply a great deal of energy in the form of light energy or temperature to cause the substances, the electrons in this case, to go from the ground state to the excited state. So the highly populated, the excited state is not populated normally until I shine the light on it that coincides or corresponds to that energy gap. Right? So the normal state at 25 degrees C is everything's in the ground state. Very little is in the excited state, 10 to the minus 41. Okay? I get to the vibrational region of the spectrum. Okay? Wagging and bending and things like that going on in the molecule. Energy transition is much smaller. Okay? At 25 degrees C, the ratio of excited state to ground state, okay, is 10 to the minus 2. So like 1% of the molecules are in the excited state just at 25 degrees C. The energy gap is very small. It doesn't take much energy to cause the transition that we're talking about. All right. Rotational. Okay, just causing rotation. It says here, excited versus ground state is almost equal. Right? The ratio is almost one. It's even closer with electron spin and nuclear spins. The point is, how am I going to see the transition? Well, it's going to be easy in the electronic case because there's nothing in the excited state and there's nothing in the ground state. So observing that transition will be easy. When it comes to vibration, it's going to be a little bit harder. When it comes to rotational electron spins and nuclear spins, it's going to be impossible. I'm going to be able to tell that one molecule of spin, when the spins, the ratio of spins are almost equal. We're going to have to use a magnet to align the spins and set the system up where we can see a change in the transition from one state to the other. So the point is, there's a difference in population. Electronic energy type spectroscopy is fairly sensitive. I can easily observe that there's a very big difference between the population of those states. I can easily observe that transition. Vibrational spectroscopy, there's not a big difference. There's some difference, 1%. So I can still do vibrational spectroscopy, and I can still measure it. It's not as good as electronic spectroscopy. The amount of the change is not as big. If you have a small change, I'm not going to be able to measure that small change. When it comes to electron spin and nuclear spin, it's very terrible. Quantitative measurements. And you have to put a distribution on them in order to be able to measure them at all. So this is something that Boltzmann's distribution tells us about the system. There it is. The spectrum of light. Right? We're going to begin to do spectroscopy. We need to say that we have something about the spectrum. So here's the spectrum, okay, all the way from radio waves down up to gamma rays. Okay, gamma rays are very important because that's what turned Bruce Banner into the Incredible Hulk. Alright? Okay. So, and then of course TV waves are very important, especially during the World Series. So what we have is this, the entire spectrum of light. Now, at the gamma ray end of things, we undergo nuclear transitions. And over in the nuclear center, we can do gamma ray spectroscopy. What do? We take a sample, we stick it in the nuclear reactor, start it with neutrons, we cause an unstable nuclei to be formed. The nuclei captures the neutrons and becomes unstable. And so we call it neutron activation. And when it becomes unstable, it then becomes a radioactive substance and disintegrates by generating gamma rays. And we measure those gamma rays. The gamma ray energy is related to the type of transition or the type of reaction that's occurring, nuclear reaction. In other words, the type of material that's giving off that characteristic energy of the gamma ray. The number of gamma rays that are given off tells you how much of the substance it is. So I can irradiate something. Okay, Dr. Eby in Earth Sciences uses it a lot. He's got a brand new system, and hopefully we'll get to use it. But he irradiates some rocks. Then he puts them in his counting system and watches. And it says, okay, there's certain transitions that are characteristic of potassium or iron or, whatever element. And then the number of transitions tells them how much of that material is present. So that's gamma ray spectroscopy. And we can do that. But that's a nuclear transition. That's high energy stuff. Okay? Then we have inner shell electrons. I told you we can deal with inner shell electrons. But I tell you, you're going to destroy a molecule if you're ripping the inner shell electrons out of it. Right? We do that with X-ray absorption or X-ray fluorescence or some kind of an X-ray technique. Downstairs in the basement, we have X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy instruments. Okay, they bombard a system with X-rays. They kick out inner shell electrons, and they see it, they measure a transition. They actually measure the, in the case of XPS, X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, they measure a photoelectron that is generated by the inner shell electron that's being ripped out of the molecule, I guess. So we can measure absorption of light by those absorption of X-rays, electromagnetic radiation, or the fluorescence, the light emitted those inner shell electrons. But that's high energy stuff. We're not going to talk about these things in this class. Perspective, inner shell electrons. Okay. Then we have outer shell electrons. That's our stuff. UV visible, absorption, fluorescence. Outer shell electrons, non-destructive. We're going to pull those molecules to an excited state, bring them back down. If you're on the edge, okay, we're on the edge here. If we're using UV light, what happens if we shine UV light on something, intense UV light for a while? You can destroy the substance, right? You can take a dye molecule. This material has a red dye in it, right? If I shine UV light on it for intense UV light for a long time, I may bleach the red out of the dye, right? If you have furniture in your house and you put it near the sunlight, it fades, right? Okay. Sometimes the dyes in the material fades over time. What's happening? Those outer shell electrons are being promoted right out of the molecule, and the molecule falls apart. Okay. So you can destroy, but normally you don't. Normally it goes to the excited state, comes back. That occurs in this region of the spectrum here. This region, I didn't talk a lot about the wavelength or the frequencies, but we have a scale here of wavelength and a scale of frequency, and it tells you gamma rays, X-rays, ultraviolet, and visible. And we have the visible region blown up because we talk about ROY. This is ROY over here, right? Oh, I think I probably have that, don't I? I have it at the end. ROY GBIV. ROY, red, orange, yellow, green, blue. Indigo is now missing from the spectrum. Indigo. Okay. Nobody likes indigo anymore. It's gone. So it's not ROY GBIV anymore. It's ROY GBV. Anyway. Okay. So that was the... electronic spectroscopy that we're going to talk mostly about. We can do molecular vibrations, which I will probably refer to a lot because it's so analogous to the kinds of things we do in electronic region of the spectrum. It's infrared absorption that we're concerned about. It's infrared region of the spectrum. All these energies, okay, these kind of energies that correspond to these kind of transitions. What else we got here? Molecular rotations, nobody cares. Microwave absorption, all we really care about is microwave popcorn and microwave, to cook our food. We can talk about spin states in NMR and EPR spectroscopy. Not too many people do EPR. It's important. Very similar to NMR and nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy. But we're dealing with different regions of the spectrum, okay? Low energy, okay, high energy. If you can't remember that, just remember, you know, gamma rays, the Incredible Hulk, right? ROY GBIV, like I said, used to be I in here. It used to be ROY GBIV. We'll talk about Beer's Law and the quantitative aspects of absorption next time. The burning question on everyone's mind, did you grade the exams? Oh, I hate grading exams, but I'm working on it. I'll get them done. Okay. Unless you don't want to grade. No grade might be better than the grade. Well, anyway. Okay, we're all set. We're all done.